Jim bought his steam engine and we went by Elmore's for my baton. Jim took no pleasure in his acquisition. He jammed it in his pocket and walked silently beside me toward home. On the way home, I nearly hit Mr. Link Dees, who said, "Look out now, Scout," when I missed a toss. And when we approached Mrs. DeBose's house, my baton was grimy from having picked it up out of the dirt so many times. She was not on the porch. In later years, I sometimes wondered exactly what made Jim do it. What made him break the bonds of, "You just be a gentleman, son," and the phase of self-conscious rectitude he had recently entered. Jim had probably stood as much guff about Atticus lawing for niggers as had I, and I took it for granted that he kept his temper. He had a naturally tranquil disposition and a slow fuse. At the time, however, I thought the only explanation for what he did was that for a few minutes he simply went mad. What Jim did was something I'd do, as a matter of course, had I not been under Atticus's interdict, which I assumed included not fighting horrible old ladies. We had just come to her gate when Jim snatched my baton and ran flailing wildly up the steps into Mrs. DeBose's front yard, forgetting everything Atticus had said, forgetting that she packed a pistol under her shawls, forgetting that if Mrs. DeBose missed, her girl Jessie probably wouldn't. He did not begin to calm down until he had cut the tops off every camellia bush Mrs. DeBose owned, until the ground was littered with green buds and leaves. He bent my baton against his knee, snapped it in two, and threw it down. By that time, I was shrieking. Jim yanked my hair, said he didn't care, he'd do it again if he got a chance, and if I didn't shut up, he'd pull every hair out of my head. I didn't shut up, and he kicked me. I lost my balance and fell on my face. Jim picked me up roughly, but looked like he was sorry. There was nothing to say. We did not choose to meet Atticus coming home that evening. We skulked around the kitchen until Calpurnia threw us out. By some voodoo system, Calpurnia seemed to know all about it. She was a less than satisfactory source of palliation, but she did give Jim a hot biscuit and butter, which he tore in half and shared with me. It tasted like cotton. We went to the living room. I picked up a football magazine, found a picture of Dixie Howell, showed it to Jim, and said, "This looks like you." That was the nicest thing I could think to say to him, but it was no help. He sat by the windows, hunched down in a rocking chair, scowling, waiting. Daylight faded. 2 geological ages later, we heard the soles of Atticus's shoes scrape the front steps. The screen door slammed. There was a pause. Atticus was at the hat rack in the hall, and we heard him call, "Jim?" His voice was like the winter wind. Atticus switched on the ceiling light in the living room and found us there, frozen still. He carried my baton in one hand. Its filthy yellow tassel trailed on the rug. He held out his other hand. It contained fat camellia buds. "Jim," he said, "are you responsible for this?" "Yes, sir." "Why'd you do it?" Jim said softly, "She said you lawed for niggers and trash." "You did this because she said that?" Jim's lips moved, but his "yes, sir" was inaudible. "Son, I have no doubt that you've been annoyed by your contemporaries about me lawing for niggers, as you say. But to do something like this to a sick old lady is inexcusable. I strongly advise you to go down and have a talk with Mrs. DeBose," said Atticus. "Come straight home afterward." Jim did not move. "Go on," I said. I followed Jim out of the living room. "Come back here," Atticus said to me. I came back. Atticus picked up the mobile press and sat down in the rocking chair Jim had vacated. For the life of me, I did not understand how he could sit there in cold blood and read a newspaper when his only son stood an excellent chance of being murdered with a Confederate Army relic. Of course, Jim antagonized me sometimes until I could kill him, but when it came down to it, he was all I had. Atticus did not seem to realize this, or if he did, he didn't care. I hated him for that. But when you are in trouble, you become easily tired. Soon I was hiding in his lap, and his arms were around me. "You're mighty big to be rocked," he said. "You don't care what happens to him," I said. "You just send him on to get shot at when all he was doing was standing up for you." Atticus pushed my head under his chin. "It's not time to worry yet," he said. "I never thought Jim would be the one to lose his head over this. Thought I'd have more trouble with you." I said I didn't see why we had to keep our heads anyway, that nobody I knew at school had to keep his head about anything. "Scout," said Atticus, "when summer comes, you'll have to keep your head about far worse things. It's not fair for you and Jim, I know that. But sometimes we have to make the best of things, and the way we conduct ourselves when the chips are down, well, all I can say is, when you and Jim are grown, maybe you'll look back on this with some compassion and some feeling that I didn't let you down. This case, Tom Robinson's case, is something that goes to the essence of a man's conscience. Scout, I couldn't go to church and worship God if I didn't try to help that man."
"Atticus, you must be wrong."
"How's that?"
"Well, most folks seem to think they're right and you're wrong."
"They're certainly entitled to think that, and they're entitled to full respect for their opinions," said Atticus. "But before I can live with other folks, I've got to live with myself. The one thing that doesn't abide by majority rule is a person's conscience." When Jim returned, he found me still in Atticus's lap. "Well, son," said Atticus. He set me on my feet, and I made a secret reconnaissance of Jim. He seemed to be all in one piece, but he had a queer look on his face. Perhaps she had given him a dose of calomel. I cleaned it up for her and said I was sorry, but I ain't, and that I'd work on 'em every Saturday and try to make 'em grow back out. "There was no point in saying you were sorry if you aren't," said Atticus. "Jim, she's old and ill. You can't hold her responsible for what she says and does. Of course, I'd rather she'd have said it to me than to either of you, but we can't always have our druthers." Jim seemed fascinated by a rose in the carpet. "Atticus," he said, "she wants me to read to her."
"Read to her?"
"Yes, sir. She wants me to come every afternoon after school and Saturdays and read to her out loud for 2 hours. Atticus, do I have to?"
"Certainly."
"But she wants me to do it for a month."
"Then you'll do it for a month."
Jim planted his big toe delicately in the center of the rose and pressed it in. Finally he said, "Atticus, it's all right on the sidewalk, but inside it's all dark and creepy. There's shadows and things on the ceiling." Atticus smiled grimly.
"That should appeal to your imagination. Just pretend you're inside the Radley house."